This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's still March and therefore still Women's History Month, and so a good time to take a look at two new reports on the state of women in North Carolina. Now, we are pretty familiar these days with studies that show how women are doing compared to men or girls compared to boys, but these two studies show that we really need to look at how women compare to each other along class and racial lines as well. Today, I'll talk with Beth Briggs. She's executive director of the North Carolina Council for Women. They released the Status of Women in North Carolina report, the first one since 1996. Amy Hess is here. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Meredith College and the lead researcher in the Status of Girls in North Carolina report. Lisa Levenstein is also here, associate professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Welcome to all of you. It's good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
Great. Thank you for having us.
Beth, let me talk with you first about the Status of Women report. This is the first one since 96. Then women were earning on average 73 cents on the dollar compared to men. How have things changed since then?
Well, we're glad to say that in that 12-year period, women now make 83 cents to the dollar. So that is a growth area. Women are more educated. Women are more active in professional management jobs, but there's still barriers. So it was a snapshot of where we were and where we're going.
And still far behind. Obviously, 83 cents is not parity, right?
Exactly.
So there you go. So that's part of it. Now, when we look at that, those are averages for women compared to men. How does that break down along racial lines?
Well, I think that's a really key issue, and that's one of the things we wanted to look at. The median income for a woman in North Carolina is $33,000 a year. If you're a white woman, it's $35,400. If you're an African-American woman or an American Indian woman, it's $29,000 a year. And if you're a Latino woman, it's $24,000 a year. So that's a significant difference by race.
That is a very interesting way to look at this. And again, as we say, we're used to studies that compare women to men and sort of how they're doing. But these class and race breakdowns, Lisa, are a real illustration of something deeper going on, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, I think we've seen, you know, throughout U.S. history, these class and racial breakdowns in the way that women's positions compare to one another. But what we're seeing today is really interesting insofar as in the past three to four decades, as it's increasingly become the norm for middle-class mothers to work full-time, what has enabled them to go out into the labor force has been, to a good degree, low-paid labor done by poorer women. So here I'm thinking about women who work in daycare centers, who are paid extremely low wages, who look after the children of middle-class women who are working full-time. Here I'm also, think about babysitters, also extremely low-wage work. Think about house cleaners, right? Or women who look after the elderly in their homes, who are looking after the parents of the middle-class women who are now in the labor force. All of these lower-wage women are doing labor that is paid gets very low wages. And it is their labor that is enabling the middle class women to go out into the workforce. What's interesting is that we rarely think about who is doing that labor for the poor women, right? Who's cleaning their houses? How are they managing to take care of their children? How are they managing to take care of their mothers and their fathers? That's the question that often we're not asking.
Well, and one way to get at that is to take a look at poverty rates for women and for girls. And Amy, I'll ask you about your study and what you found in terms of poverty in girls in North Carolina.
Well, it really echoes a lot of what Beth and Lisa and, you know, you have just been detailing that, you know, when you look at poverty rates for example, the youngest girls, girls under five, the picture is not good for any girl. Among girls under five in North Carolina, about 30% are living in families that are below the poverty line. But when you look again by racial and ethnic status, when you look at African American, Latina, or American Indian young girls, one in two, 50%. You know, these are staggering figures. And so I think that what we're seeing among children is obviously reflected in what's going on with adult women.
So let's talk about these families that these girls are a part of. And as you say, 50% of the girls are members of families that are living in poverty if you're a Native American or African American and Latina as well.
It's close, slightly lower, but right about there.
So let's talk about these families, because if we look at the study on women, let's talk about heads of household, who's running the household, and the economic burdens that they might face. Beth?
Well, a third of the women in North Carolina that are head of households are single mothers. And we know that if you're a single mother, the median income for a woman in North Carolina is a little over $20,000. That is not sustainable. The issues, again, going back to the issues of poverty that Amy mentioned, that 30% of white women in the state are living in poverty or at near poverty. 52% of African-American women at or near poverty, 64% of Latino women at or near poverty, and 54% of American Indians. These are very significant numbers.
And over 40%, sorry to interject here, over 40% of families headed by women, by single mothers, so assuming they have children, it's 44% of those families are living in poverty.
So when you look at that and you think about the burden that single mothers have, they now have – they're out in the workforce. They're making less than men. Maybe there's been a small advance. But the burden, the economic burden, is greater. And that, in a way, that doesn't, Lisa, get worked into the statistics. We see so-called progress from 72 to 83 cents, and yet we don't measure the fact that the burden they had going in was greater than the average man who might be part of a two-member household if he's working or single.
Absolutely. And I think this conversation is extremely important because we really need to address the specific struggles that single mothers face. And, you know, the struggles they face providing for children, looking after a household on their own, which is, you know, a very unique struggle. We need to address that particular struggle at the same time that, I mean, often these conversations then turn into a conversation that blames single motherhood for women's poverty, right? And so often, and we see this really, you know, started in the 60s, it probably even goes dates back earlier than this, a conversation really that we see both among conservatives and liberals who have tended to look at single motherhood and say that is the root of poverty, particularly among African Americans and particularly in our nation's cities. And that discourse, that conversation actually really masks what is actually happening, which is that single mothers aren't poor because they are single. They are poor because they are not earning enough money. They are poor because they don't have adequate, affordable childcare and housing and all of these other kinds of basic needs that need to be met for any kind of family. They're not poor because they are single mothers. And I think it's absolutely critical that we change the conversation to look at the real roots of women's poverty, because that really shapes how we think about the solutions.
And so what are those roots, do you think?
So the if you believe that single mothers are poor because they're single, then the solution to women's poverty and to poverty in general is just everyone should get married. Right. And marriage, we know from studies in history, from studies in sociology, from studies in social work, from studies across the board in every discipline, we understand that marriage is no solution to women's poverty. It is not the solution. What are the solution are things like raising the minimum wage. Wow. It's amazing what studies have shown that can do for women's poverty. Providing affordable subsidized childcare that the government, you know, sees as a public good. These kinds of things can really help to start address the issues that women face.
And Beth, when you look at the women's wages, there's a broader picture about women in the workforce and the lack of support that they have in terms of their job. I'm talking about sick time now, health benefits, all of that. Tell us about women and how they're covered just in terms of health care coverage.
Well, that is one of the changes we've seen since the study was done in 96. About 80% of women in North Carolina. If you're a native-born woman, you have some type of health insurance. If you're an immigrant woman, it's about 54%. And only about 44% of women working full-time have paid leave. So if your child's sick, if you're sick, either you can't afford to take a day off or you take a day off and you lose a lot of money. So I think those are key issues. And I think in terms of what Lisa was saying, one of the barriers that we see is that child care is it's so critical. We know we want the most important thing when we leave our children is to make sure they're in good hands. If you're leaving your child, the median cost for child care in North Carolina, if you're leaving your child in a certified child care facility, it's about $9,185 for an infant and about $7,700 a year for a four-year-old. Now, that's very significant if you're making $33,000 a year. It's also significant in that it is more than the cost of a tuition at a public university today.
Also interesting to think about what would happen if we could pay a living wage for a single earner, male or female, who made their way into the workplace so that a man or woman could stay home. If because a generation ago, a generation and a half ago now, that was more or less the norm. Somebody stayed home. It turned out to be men. Maybe we want to fix that. You can't do that anymore. So that points to severe economic shifts in our own economy that require two people to be at work, not just allow, but require. We're going to talk more about this, the status of men and girls in the state of North Carolina, with Beth Briggs, Executive Director of the North Carolina Council for Women, Amy Hess, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Meredith College, Lisa Levenstein, Associate Professor of History at UNCG. Just ahead, we'll continue the conversation on the state of things. From North Carolina Public Radio, it's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about women and girls in our state, Amy Hess is with me. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Meredith College. Beth Briggs, executive director of North Carolina Council for Women. Lisa Levenstein, associate professor of history at UNC Greensboro. Two reports recently issued in the state about the status of women and the status of girls. And Amy, at Meredith College, you were working on the status of girls and found that girls have seen gains in education. Tell us about that.
Well, it's true that I think when we went into this, when we were starting to pull the data on education, we looked primarily at North Carolina tests all children. They call them end of grade tests in third, fifth, seventh, and eighth grade, as well as end of course exams once the children are in high school. And I think we were anticipating to see sort of a drop off among girls in those, you know, what we call STEM fields, science, technology, education, engineering, and mathematics. And we didn't see that. So in middle schools, when we typically think about girls sort of disengaging from science and math, and what we found when you look at the eighth grade, end of grade passing rates are that girls are really right on par with boys, in some cases slightly ahead of boys, even in those fields, but essentially right on par with boys.
Do we know what's happening once they get to college, Beth? I don't know if your report looked at that directly, but in terms of are they following through and getting degrees in these subjects?
Well, still about 90% of all engineering graduates are male. So we do see fewer percentage of women continuing. However, that's been a tremendous growth area for women.
And it is true that the state, North Carolina, has about 130, I think it's 131, STEM-focused high schools, and girls make up 49% of the student body in those schools. So I think the state has put a lot of effort into encouraging girls to enter and sort of stay in those fields. So I think that's really important, though girls are less, they're sort of overrepresented in schools that have a life sciences focus in those high schools versus those high schools that have an engineering focus. So even at the high school level, we still are seeing that divergence emerge. So while they're both in sciences, girls are sort of selecting or being pushed in some ways into more life science focused.
What about racial disparities or distinctions in your report?
Yeah, that is sort of the theme of today. And in some ways, I almost wish we had called this report the statuses of girls in North Carolina, because we really do see so much divergence or inequality among girls by racial and ethnic status. And we see this in education as well. So that girls, African-American, Latina, American Indian young women, their passing rate on these end of grade and end of course examinations is much lower, substantially lower than white girls, Asian girls, and interestingly, multiracial girls have fairly high passing rates, more on par with white and Asian young women. The gap persists into high school, but it does start to narrow. So I think that's really important, that we do see some narrowing of the racial, ethnic, educational achievement gap as girls move into high school.
Any guesses what's going on?
Some of it is probably selection. The end of course exams are only kids who take those courses. So that I think that some of the more high achieving racial minorities or ethnic minorities are self-selecting into those courses. And so then they're going to be more likely to pass those courses. I mean, we're still looking at Algebra 1, Biology 1. So they're still lower level, but not every student is necessarily going to take those courses.
That's interesting, too, to think about some of the research that's been done at the elementary level to show how subtle racism plays a part in tracking students and getting them into the GT track or the LD track or a track that will not take them into a STEM course. We've seen ample evidence of that happening at the very earliest level, so that by the time they show up in your report, you know, a lot of the damage has been done.
Right. And it seems sort of it seems like it's a choice, right, versus a way in which, you know, you're sort of just going with the flow, a flow that you didn't necessarily select into, but one that was selected for you.
Very early on. Well, Beth, what about education in general when we see women's education? And this now we'll compare to men.
Well, this has been another huge growth for women. About 1 million more women are going into college every year than men. About 650,000 more women are getting advanced degrees than men. However, this does not relate to wage equity. What we found in the study in North Carolina, if you're a woman with a bachelor's degree or higher, you're making 71 cents to the dollar of a man. And you're earning about $20,000 less per year than a man.
I want to stop you there because, interestingly enough, generally, overall, women are making 83 cents to the dollar compared to men. With a bachelor's degree, the rate falls, the gap grows. What do you think is happening?
Well, it's an interesting issue because one of the things that are happening is that the salaries of men have gone down. That if you are a Latina, you're making the same as a Latino, 24,000 men and women. So there's no wage gap there. If you're an African-American woman, you're making it's just the wage gap is different. And unfortunately, the more educated you are, it's just not reflecting in your wage. And that goes back to what Lisa was saying as well, is that so many women are going into the care issues, health care, child care, elder care. And there is an undervaluation of what women are paid in these fields. So they may be working, may have degrees, but they're not reflecting in the income. And again, if you're making $20,000 less per year with a bachelor's degree, that relates to about $250,000 over your lifetime that you will not earn. And the impact on families is tremendous.
And the bill you paid to get that degree is the same as the guys who got there. So what about in the higher echelons, the higher levels of corporate structure? Where do we see women there?
Well, this is an interesting study. Women 2.0 just came out with a study that talked about CEOs. And they're comparing the income of CEO women to CEO men. And CEO women are making about 33 cents to the dollar of a CEO man of this country.
So the higher you go, the wider the gap, both in education and in terms of career ladder, right?
It's surprising. If you're a woman with a bachelor's degree, you're making the equivalent of a man with just a few years of college.
Wow. Lisa, any guesses what's going on there?
Well, I think I really – what Beth said earlier about this maybe about the – increasing status of women at the lower echelons of the pay scale, reflecting not necessarily gains among women, but losses among men and among low-income men, rings extremely true to me, right? And we see those jobs that don't require as much education. I mean, all jobs really today, but particularly the jobs, you know, in the service sector, in the industrial sector, you know, really losing ground, you know, paying less, offering fewer benefits, all of that happening. And so I think that really it might not, I mean, you might not even want to call it a gain for women when it really reflects just basically the conditions of everybody's labor declining.
Right. And you can see that most clearly if you pull all the way back and you take a look at huge gains in productivity overall reflected in record profits on Wall Street and still unemployment stuck at around 8%, which has a damaging effect, a huge depressing effect on wages for everybody. Well, I want to move on and change the subject a little bit, Beth, and talk about the status of women in a more troubling area when it comes to domestic violence. Tell us about what you found.
Well, the Council for Women is very involved in domestic violence and research in the state. The Council funds programs throughout North Carolina, about 250 programs across North Carolina. And it continues to be disturbing both at a national level and in North Carolina. One in four women is a victim of domestic violence at the hands of an intimate partner. One in four women is a victim of sexual assault at the hands of an individual. And these are really tremendous numbers considering where we are. One in four girls in college is a victim of sexual assault today, and one in six boys is a victim of sexual assault before he reaches the age of 18.
How has that changed since your last report, or did the last report take that on?
Well, I think what's happening, there's more people reporting that there are. I think that's one of the good things, is that there's a lot more awareness about domestic violence, sexual assault, and people are coming forward. There are resources available for them. But these numbers are still disturbing in North Carolina, and the ability to provide safety for women and families continues to be a huge need. The number one cause of homelessness among women is domestic violence.
Did the report take into account race and economic status, and do the statistics change dramatically as those indicators change?
Well, I don't have that data today, but there is data on that, so I'm just not very educated on it today.
Lisa, what about the link between generally women's economic status and rates of domestic violence?
Yeah, well, you do see a correlation there, most certainly. But also, I think what's really interesting about the persistence of both sexual assault and domestic violence in women's lives is the way that the feminist movement of the 1970s really, identified and gave a language with which we could speak about these issues, and politicized both domestic violence and sexual assault in really fundamental ways. In a way, the success of the feminist movement in bringing attention to these issues meant that there was increased funding for them. We have, increased public awareness. All of this is extremely good, but it has also, in a certain sense, depoliticized these issues in a way that we don't have the kind of a lot of domestic violence shelters and rape crisis centers, for example, in the 1970s, had an explicitly feminist bent. They came right out of the women's movement. And today, they're nonprofits that are answerable to, large funding structures. And so the way that we've provided these services has really changed over time. I think what's very interesting is that we are seeing now on college campuses today, we see it at UNC, but we also see it around the nation, a resurgence of young women's feminist activism surrounding sexual assault and sexual violence that we saw earlier in the 1980s. And then there was a significant public backlash against that activism among young women and young men on college campuses in the 80s, a significant backlash. The problem did not go away, however, and now we're seeing a resurgence of young women and some young men speaking out about this as a fundamental issue in their lives that they want to take on.
Well, Beth, what do you make of this? Because as you point out, and as Lisa just said, there has been a huge increase in awareness and in funding and in centers that are available for counseling and support. And yet it seems like the problem, even if there's just more reporting, at the very least, it has not gotten any better. Why?
Well, it's a power dynamic, and there are so many issues around domestic violence, sexual assault. It's a very complicated issue. And I think I know that Amy probably understands this as well, that it's what people see in their families. It's what do we teach our boys? What do we teach our girls? How do we make sure that girls know that they do not have to submit? There's I think you have some of the data on the girls' first sexual encounters, that so many of these girls need to know that they don't have to be fearful. They can say no. And boys need to be taught no means no, and the respect for women.
Well, tell us about that, Amy, what you found in terms of sexual health for girls in the state.
Well, just to pick up on the topic of sexual assault first, April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, so I want to put in a plug for that. So hopefully we can think of this as an opportunity to talk to young people, but particularly young men. I think a lot of the focus on sexual assault awareness tends to be around young women and teaching them what to do and what not to do. But the reality is we need to be talking to young men. And one of the things that we found is that parents in North Carolina are really talking to their children about sex and their expectations around sexual activity, but that they're significantly more likely to talk to young women than young men. And, you know, I think that that's it's great that they're talking to their kids, but I think to a certain extent, we often are letting young men off the hook as a society and within our families. And I think that we need to bring young men into the conversation in a productive way. That, you know, women and young women in North Carolina, teens are twice as likely to report being forced to have sexual intercourse. So not just sexual assault, but specifically rape. About 12% of high schoolers in North Carolina, high school females report having been raped. And there is
12% of all the girls in North Carolina in high school report being raped.
Right. These are not official. They haven't necessarily made official police reports. We know that rape and all forms of sexual assault and domestic violence are, you know, the most underreported crimes. But yes, they have indicated it on a survey.
Yeah.
Right. So 12%. So 1 in 10. Yeah. You know, so more than 1 in 10 girls in North Carolina, high school girls, black young women, African American young women, it's almost 15%.
And you say that girls now are more likely to be talking with their families about sex than boys are, which puts significant pressure then on girls. They know what to talk about. They may have a vocabulary, but then it puts the burden on them to have the conversation.
Precisely.
With the boy.
We sort of reinforce this idea that girls, and again, it's so tenuous for these young women, teenagers, to be put in that position of sort of sexual responsibility, of policing the sort of boundaries of what's appropriate or what's inappropriate in terms of sexual activity and sexual contact on behalf of not just themselves, but young men, assuming we're talking about heterosexual activity here. So I think that that's a heavy burden to put on to young women.
Assuming that all, at least many of the solutions to this, if there are any, can be found in the political arena, let's talk about women in politics. Beth, your report shows that they are more engaged. And certainly if we look around women, there are more women in positions of power anyway. Again, not equity. Tell us what you found.
Well, in the North Carolina General Assembly, about 23% of members of the legislature are women. We're 51% of the population. We're highly educated in the state, more college degrees of women. And we know in order for issues that affect women and girls, we need our voice represented both at the in government as well as corporations. When women are in leadership in these areas, they're more likely to be attuned to those issues that affect
women. Women vote more than men.
They do. In 2012, 69% of women voted in the election compared to 66% of men. So women are voting.
Women are voting. They're not quite equally represented. What does this mean in terms of public policy, then, this kind of engagement? Lisa?
Well, what I think is fascinating that you found in your report, Beth, and certainly has played out historically, is the significant involvement of women in not only voting, but in kind of political activism broadly conceived. And we know historically that this has been a significant role that women have taken on. You know, women organizers were the backbones of the civil rights movement, right? And women have always played a significant role, often behind the scenes, right? If you think about, even if you've been involved in party politics at all, who are the people who are running the Republican headquarters in, you know, Chapel Hill on some street corner, right? I mean, it's often the women who are doing this kind of work. So what's fascinating is that, and then the women who are voting. So women are not represented when it comes to being actually elected for office. What this suggests, the discrepancy between women's involvement in politics and their representation in office, is that this does not reflect a disinterest among women in politics. Women are extremely engaged in politics and extremely active in the political sphere. So why isn't that translating into more representation in the legislature?
Not only more representation, but in terms of public policy and in policies that would in many ways support some of the issues that would make things better for women. Why not? What is happening there? Beth, what do you think?
Well, I think that women are becoming more politically active. in their speaking about these topics. Well, actually, I'll have to say 40 years ago, women were talking about these very same issues that we're talking about today. So things have not changed as quickly as I think we thought they would. However, it's about awareness. One of the things that concerns me is that how young people are getting their news these days, particularly young women. It's not – now, if they listen to the state of things, they're understanding what's going on in North Carolina. However, I think a lot more young people are getting their news on the internet from national publications, New York Times, and they're not necessarily reading about local news. So they may not be as involved at a local level on local issues.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program, and I wish we had more time. But thank you all. Beth Briggs, Executive Director of the North Carolina Council for Women. They released the Status of Women in North Carolina report. Amy Hess is Assistant Professor of Sociology at Meredith College, the lead researcher on the Status of Girls in North Carolina report. Lisa Levenstein, Associate Professor of History at UNC Greensboro. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Coming up next on the State of Things, the sinking of the Bounty. Stay tuned.